Today's Tae Show will be on Case 84, Wee Ma's The Gate to the One and Only. Engo's introduction, there is nothing right that can be truly called right. There is no wrong that can be truly called wrong. With right and wrong eliminated, gains and losses are forgotten. It is all naked and exposed. Now I want to ask you, what is in front of me and what is behind me? Some monk may come forward and say that in front there are the Buddha hall and the temple gate, and behind the bedroom and the sitting room. Tell me, is that man open-eyed? If you can see through him, I will acknowledge that you have seen the ancient worthy. Main subject. Wee Ma asked Manjushri, what is the Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only? Manjushri answered, to my mind, in all dharmas, there are no words, no preaching, no talking, no activity of consciousness. It is beyond all questions and answers. This is entering the gate to the one and only. Then Manjushri said to Wee Ma, each of us has had his say. Now I ask you, what is the Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only? Secho says, what did Wee Ma say? And again he says, I have seen through him. Secho's verse, you old foolish Wee Ma Kitsu, sorrowful for ancient beings, you lie sick in Bayali, your body all withered up. The teacher of the seven Buddhas comes. The room is cleared of everything. You ask for the gate to the one and only. Are you repulsed by Manju's words? No, not repulsed. The golden-haired lion can find you nowhere. The main character in this subject is Wee Ma, which is actually a Chinese version of Vimalakirti. Vimalakirti was a great Indian meditation master, who is the subject of the Vimalakirti Nirdesa Sutra. And he was a great enlightened arhat, great bodhisattva, living in Vaishali, which is translated into Japanese as Biali. But Vaishali was where he lived. And he is the subject of a sutra, a great Mahayana sutra. And basically the story was that, Vimalakirti was a great enlightened master, but he lived as a lay person. He had a job, and he had a house responsibility for a home. And he had a business, basically, and he was deeply awake. He represented, for many generations of Buddhist practitioners, he has represented a kind of ideal person, because he's in the world, but he's able to be in enlightened mind at the same time. And a really exemplary figure in Buddhist history, and also a great inspiration to many generations of Buddhist practitioners. In the story, there's a story about Wee Ma, about Vimalakirti. Basically, the story is that he was living in Vaishali, and the Buddha himself came to preach in Vaishali. And Vimalakirti was one of the Buddha's foremost disciples, but he failed to appear at the Buddha's talk, and he sent word that he wasn't there because he was sick, because he was ill. And this has been a kind of koan for Buddhist community ever since. The illness of Manjushri and the failure to attend the talk of the Buddha. And the Buddha sent after him. There's other aspects to this also, because the Buddha put a question to all his enlightened disciples, and then Manjushri asked Vimalakirti the same question, and Vimalakirti's answer is supposed to have been superior to the answer given by any of the other of the Buddha's disciples. So I think I represented that correctly, that the Buddha sent all of the disciples to Wima for the answer, and they all told him what they would say, and then he told them how he would answer the question. So they're all going to visit him in his house where he's ill, or his mind ill. The Buddha said, if you want to understand something, you want to understand enlightenment, you know, go talk to Vimalakirti. And they all go over to his house, and the sutra is a later sutra, so there's many miraculous events. So there's a legion of followers, but somehow they all get into Vimalakirti's tiny little house. And this is a miracle of some kind. You know. Maybe they're all just really crammed in, you know. But the point is that they're all deeply practicing Zen, or Buddhism anyway. They've all had various kensho, and the Buddha said, if you really want to understand something, go to see Wima, go to see Vimalakirti. So this is the background of the koan, and the koan sort of zeroes in on one aspect of the story. Wima asked Manjushri, what is the Buddha's gate to the one and only? Manjushri answered, to my mind, in all dharmas there are no words, no preaching, no talking, no activity of consciousness. It is beyond all questions and answers. That is entering the gate to the one and only. Then Manjushri said to Vimalakirti, each of us has had his say. Now I ask you, what is the Bodhisattva's gate to the one and only? So the koan is, what did he say? What did he say? So this is day 5 of our sesshin, our marvelous, wonderful sesshin. This is just, you have to admit, we couldn't have asked for better weather, right? I mean, we're in a strange world here, you know. Maybe we've died and we don't know it, because it's just so, weather is just so perfect, right? It's just neither too hot nor too cold. It's, you know, warm in the day, hot and cool in the night, full moon overhead. You know, beautiful, beautiful conditions for practice. And everybody has been doing a wonderful job. People have been coming into Dokusan with real wonderful answers. Obviously, they're making a serious effort. We have a little bit of time left, and not much. But please continue to apply yourselves. Anything can happen between now and this afternoon. We leave at 6, and we'll have Dokusan at 4:30. I must say that that yesterday, I don't know about yesterday's Taisho. I've been thinking maybe we should just delete it and say that it was lost, something was wrong. I'm afraid that I might hurt people's feelings, you know. I got up this morning and I thought that maybe I was too dogmatic. I was troubled by yesterday's Taisho. I thought maybe, you know, it is true in a certain sense that, well, it's absolutely true. So now I'm going to do it again. It's absolutely true that if you don't come to Sesshin, you're not practicing Zen. It's absolutely true. You know, the great Bodhisattva, who started the Vipassana movement in India, Goenka, has a standing talk that he gives on. He says there's people who follow the Buddha and there's admirers of the Buddha. And admirers of the Buddha are people who read sutras and worship Buddha images and respect the Buddha, and it's a good thing there in the world. And then followers of the Buddha go to retreats because that's what the Buddha did. And so that's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. On the other hand, you know, I really didn't mean any disrespect to people who might be too busy to come to Sesshin, or people who might be afraid to come to Sesshin, you know. The world is a complicated place, and not everybody might be ready to come to Sesshin, but I certainly want them to feel that they're welcome in our Sangha. What I meant was that, you know, at some point, if you're practicing Zen, you know, you ought to come to Sesshin, you know, to give it a try. You know, there are people in our group who come to Sesshin, come to sit, and have come to sit literally for years. And they come in and they say how much it means to them to sit, and it is frustrating to me to that they never come to Sesshin. It's like because the truth is you cannot have a deep insight sitting on a Thursday night or a Monday night and doing 2 half-hours of meditation. That's just not going to happen. And any insight that seems to arise is very shallow. You know, when we do this kind of practice, we're sitting for we're actually meditating. We're sitting for, I think, something like 10 or 11 hours. But we're actually in meditation for about 8 or 9 hours. And, you may feel that at home you have deep sits. You know, but these sits are incomparably deeper and incomparably vaster. There's no comparison. You know, when you come to Sesshin, you go through a process of transformation that's very deep. And you may not feel it while you're here. You know, people come in to see me in Dokusan sometime, and they complain, they say, you know, I'm just not in deep mushin, I guess. And so I will say, you know, I have this little thing that I ask people to do. I say, you know, can you see my face? Yes. Now you'll close your eyes. Can you still see my face? Yes. That's the screen of your mind, right? When you look with your mind's eye, you can see my face. When I ask you and show you the face, and then the image fades away very quickly. But then I say, please call Mu 3 or 4 times, and then look at that screen. And sometimes people are shocked. They'll say, it's blank. Why it's blank? You know. And indeed, it is blank. You know, and it's blank all the time. So, you know, it's a little bit like somebody running around the room saying, I can't find my head. I've lost my head. Where is it? I can't, and I'm desperately searching for my head. And it's like you're on, you know, the obvious answer, right? And so this is the ground of being, and it's there all the time. And actually, after 3 or 4 days of sesshin, if you go moo, 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 and you look in there, you'll see it's blank. And so you're not so far away, see? And indeed, if you feel like your mind is running amok, you know, after calling moo for 4, 5, 6 times, look inside and see the blankness. Get to know that blankness, because that's your true nature. You know, if your koan is moo, when you come into the room, you should sit down on the cushion and focus on that blankness and then call moo. And all day long when you're practicing, periodically you should go back to that blankness. It's always there. You know, it's the most wonderful thing in the world. You know, we think that it's, well, because Zen produces transformation on a very gradual basis, very gradually, people don't understand how much they're changed by the practice for a long time. So, you know, if you come to the evening sits on a Thursday night, within about a year, 6 months to a year, you're going to be able to sit pretty comfortably for 2 periods of meditation, and maybe even come to the Thursday sit and be able to get through the Thursday sit. And you know, because it's a little change every time you sit, you don't realize what a great change that is. And the truth is that you know, being able to look into your mind and see a blank screen is quite an amazing achievement. It takes years of practice to be able to do that. And to be able to hold your attention on that blankness over and over again for hours on end. And it's not continuous, I want to say, I know. You know, there's thoughts, there's sensation. But to keep returning to that blankness for hours on end in the course of a day is an amazing feat that requires great mental training. And it's absolutely essential to any advanced insight, any advanced practice in Zen, is to be able to do that feat. And so if you're able to do it, you know, don't sell yourself short. You've come a long, long way. And on the other hand, another illusion for people is that they feel that this is just an interminable process, and that they'll never do it. You know, this is on a certain, you know, usually like on a Wednesday night, there's a certain number of people who just feel like, I'll never do it. I'm just worn to the bone and I'll never do it. This is just too vast an undertaking. And you know, first of all, to those people I want to say, you know, you aren't trapped in Zen. You know, I will always be your friend even if you stop sitting. You know, nobody should ever come to sesshin or continue to practice Zen because they're afraid of, say, hurting my feelings or something like that. You know, and you won't turn into a monster if you stop practicing Zen. You won't turn into a monster if you stop coming to sesshin. That's not going to happen. You won't wake up. That won't happen. Unless it's one of a spontaneous kensho, which occasionally happens to people, but don't count on it, you know. Unlikely that experience, but, you know, not everybody wants to wake up. I understand that. You know, in fact, the world is full of people who don't want to wake up. You know, I am married to somebody whom I love, and I've been married to for 30 years. And this enterprise just doesn't make sense to her. She's not critical of it. She understands it intellectually, but it doesn't have this driving desire to practice the way. And it just doesn't have it. People are always amazed. They'll say, well, does your wife sit? And I'll say, no. And I'm always a little nervous about this line of questioning, you know, because people will say, I was at the Hackett's house, and Delia, who's a wonderful person, she said, well, does your wife sit? And I said, I smiled, it's a double. She said, not even a little bit? You know, and I, no, indeed, not even a tiny little bit. You know, not even a little teeny weeny bit, you know, in 30 years. It's not her thing. I don't love her less because of that. Naturally, it would have been wonderful to practice together. And who knows, anything can happen. I could go home tomorrow and find her on the cushion. Could happen. But it's not likely, you know. The point is that I'm not going to file for divorce because my wife doesn't do a Zen practice. You know, I understand that that's not her path anymore. I hope she won't file for divorce because I must, you know. And I don't think that's going to happen. So the point is, you know, anybody who wants to get off the bus can always get off the bus. I'm not going to think less of you. If, you know, I love my wife and we've formed wonderful friendships through practice, and you're under no compunction or no obligation to do this after 4:30 or after 6 o'clock today ever again, or to do Zazen practice ever again. You know, so please don't ever feel like you're, now I've done it. You know, I mean, for the duration. What have I done? You know, it's like I'm signed in blood and I can't get out of this thing. It's not, if you're here, you chose to be here. If you come back, you chose to come back. You know, I wasn't trying to shame anybody yesterday into signing up for the January session or something like that. You know, I understand people can't always come to session. I was trying to encourage those who aren't here through the medium of modern technology about the January session. But on the other hand, I'm not passing judgment. I'm not in the business of judging anybody. I'm very grateful to all of you for attending, and I will treasure our friendship forever and ever, and it will be something I never forget. Even if you never do Zazen again for another moment, you know. So anyway, this, I wanted to get this off the table because I felt maybe my remarks yesterday could be misconstrued. Also, I need to say something about the Bible. You know, I wasn't running the Bible down. I really wasn't. You know, I have many Buddhist friends who study the sutras the same way Christians study the Bible, and it has the same effect on me. I just think, this is not the way, you know. Basically, the Buddha actually never said, please study all my teachings in detail. He said, he taught the practice of meditation. He says, these are the levels of meditation. First you enter this state, then you enter this state. This is samadhi, this is nirvana. You know, so he was very specific. And it's not any particular holy book that can become a kind of distraction or diversion from awakening. They all can. Buddhist books no less than Christian books or Muslim books or Jewish books or anything else. So it wasn't an anti-Bible discussion. It was saying, don't mistake idea, don't mistake the finger for the moon. In Zen we have this saying, don't mistake the finger for the moon. The concept of Buddha is not enlightenment. And so you know, you can leave here and go home and read all the Buddhist books you like. I understand why if it keeps you on a cushion, that's fantastic. But when you sit, please don't think about any of them. You know, just realize that's all another dimension that's much less real than this one. And anything can happen under a cushion. So, those are the qualifications for yesterday's teisho. Now I can start this teisho. In a way, I already have, I guess, because Vimalakirti was a person of extraordinary compassion, and he worked very hard to help other human beings to wake up and to overcome their fears and attachments. And he lived as a lay person because it allowed him to be helpful to others. He was a bodhisattva, so that means basically he was in the world helping people, and people have all kinds of abilities and aptitudes and all kinds of outlooks. And you know, sometimes helping people doesn't mean showing them the cushion. It might just mean buying some groceries for them because they're sick, or driving somebody who's too old to drive to a church or a synagogue or someplace like that. So, you know, helping others in these ways is part of the bodhisattva life. We sit on the cushion, but everybody else doesn't have to do that. The truth is that when we sit on the cushion, we are in an interesting place, because you know everybody has troubles. Everybody has troubles. I think it's cliche. Everybody has problems, whether they sit or not. So there are people who, right now are, in financial difficulties, or they failed their exam, or they're not getting into medical school, or something like that. And they've lost a big lawsuit, and so on. And they're in trouble, and they need help, and they'll try to get through it somehow. When we come to Zen practice, we are responding to a life of trouble. We've seen it again and again, and so we're pursuing kind of path of liberation. This is why we're here. Probably on some level we've all seen some trouble. Maybe it's been personal trouble, and maybe it's been the trouble, witnessing trouble of others. I owe my father so much. Somebody told me the other day, he said, you've got a father fixation. You talk about your father all the time. And I really don't think I do. It's just, he had a big influence on me when I was growing up because he was my father. And I also think I owe him a great deal because he made a lot of mistakes in life. And seeing his mistakes, I tried to live a different life. I tried to learn from his mistakes. And I often think that, my father had like a very serious drinking problem, and I myself don't drink. And I think it's because I saw what alcohol did to my dad. So I'm much in his debt. And every once in a while I'll get up and I'll come into the Zendo and I'll just think, I owe a lot, I think I owe a great deal to my dad because I'm walking this path partly because I saw his unhappiness. I just didn't want to be unhappy like that. I didn't particularly think he deserved it, but he didn't know how to get out of it, you know. So it makes me really appreciate walking into the Zendo in the morning on a sesshin. I kind of feel like I'm, you know, my dad can't be here, but I can be here. And I owe him a lot for that. You know, so anyway, we're here because of the troubles we've seen. We've had a lot of, we have personal troubles, probably too, you know. And we come to sesshin for liberation from our troubles. This is what the Buddha taught. There's suffering and a release from suffering. So, when we sit on the cushion, we're pursuing release from suffering. And it's possible to respond to our suffering by going into a kind of stillness, you know. And this is what we must do in a certain way. You have to find that stillness. So, for example, when you're practicing Zen at first, you know, when you do 8 or 9 hours of meditation a day, you're in a lot of pain, right? And we had at this session 2 new people who have just done an amazing job. One could only come for 2 days, but said she was coming back in January. And basically both of these people, I would come into the Dokusan room and I would say, you know, I would get out the Kleenex thinking, I'm going to have to console these people, because I certainly needed to be consoled at my first session. But I don't need the Kleenex, you know, they're bouncing around, doing fine, sitting like rocks, and it's so deeply impressive. It astounds me. But truth is that, generally speaking, beginners are in a lot of pain on the cushion. And I always tell them that the thing you need to do is find this stillness, you know, find that stillness. And it's absolutely crucial. So you watch the breath and you watch the breath, and eventually, if the breath becomes very long and fine, long, fine breath, you know, if you follow it out, you can reach a point where you feel very still, very still. And it's like the pain might still be there, but it's at the edges of your consciousness. It's like the eye of a tornado. It's absolutely still while, you know, pain is whirling around you. And we learn how to go into that stillness, that deep, deep stillness. It's so important. And indeed, unless you can become still, as still as death, you know, cannot achieve liberation. This is quite important, this part of the koan, is that we don't want to just staying in that stillness might not be adequate. We have to be in that stillness, but we have to turn our attention also sometimes to the source of our pain, or the source of our fear, or the source of our anxiety. In other words, what do I mean by that? I mean, once we're in the stillness, we can look at our fear, we can look at our anxiety, and we can look at our anger or whatever. And usually the koan is pointing us towards something in particular. And when we're there, the point is, if you see your fear, the question is, where does this fear, that once you're in the stillness and you see your fear, the question you can ask yourself is, where does this stillness come from? See? Or if you're unwell, say, where does this illness come from? Or if you are angry, where does this anger come from? And basically, there are lots of answers you could give. You know, if you're angry, you could say, well, I'm angry because My older brother always used to push me around, and I still feel like everybody's pushing me around. That's a psychological explanation. But a Buddhological explanation, a Zen explanation, is not quite like that, although those insights might arise as you're practicing. See, at this moment, where does the fear arise from? See, this is the Buddhist way to ask the question. At this moment, where does my fear arise from? Where is it coming from? So, you know, we think there's a past, a present, and a future. And when we try to explain something, we always go to the past and say, well, these were the causes. But actually, when we're in Buddha mind, when we're in Wuxin, there's only just the present moment. So all of our answers are to be found in the present moment only. So if you confront anger in yourself, you want to say, where is that anger coming, arising from? And indeed, even thoughts can be approached this way. People will say, I come into the Dokusan room and they'll say, I'm having obsessive thoughts. I just can't stop the flow of thoughts. And you know, that's an interesting thing. Where are those thoughts coming from? Now, if you say they're coming from my mind, please look at your mind and see where in your mind they're coming from. If you say they're coming from the past or memory, then you're not in Wuxin. And we just look at the present moment, and all of our answers to all of our questions are in the present moment. So everything, whatever you confront, anger, fear, sickness, so on and so on, all of these things are arising in the moment from some place where. And in this way, this is the practice. This is Zen practice. So, you know, when we have troubles, when we have a problem, we want to get into that stillness, and we want to be as still as we possibly can. But then you can enter a kind of a stillness where nothing happens for a long time. Even though there are pressing matters, you know, I know a person who was working on a koan, and the koan person's mother had just died, basically, and that person was entering the stillness, entering stillness through the koan, but the mother's just died, but not approaching this subject with the koan. And this can go on for years and years, and then people come in and say, well, nothing's happening with my koan. The koan's pointing towards something that has to be traced back to the source in the way I've described. And if you don't look at it, or if you turn away from it, then you don't resolve the koan, and you just stay stuck in the koan. There's so many examples of this, and I'm trying to think of a koan I won't give you, so I could give you a real example. But maybe I won't. Maybe you get what I'm saying. Maybe you just have to be there. But the point is that all of our suffering, all of our problems, all of our crises can be used to help us wake up. See, I mean, it's really important to understand that we don't know how long we're going to live. We don't know how our life is going to turn out. You know, the people we love may disappear from the earth you know, before we know it. And things we value may disappear. You just don't know, you know. And things happen to us and they hurt us. You know, they hurt. You can use your Zen practice to have sort of like get out of the way of that pain or those events. But another way to practice is to confront them face to face in that stillness and then go to the source. And that usually requires some, it's usually difficult to work through one's pain. Here's an example I could give you. When I was in graduate school in English, if you have a PhD in certain fields, people try to hire you before you even finish your PhD. So if you're a certain kind of engineer, for example, and you're really good at it, people will come and try to get you, recruit you. This is true in the sciences a lot of times. If you're a really like top-notch science student in some of the sciences, people try to get you to come and work for them. On the other hand, if you have a PhD in English, you know, there's a job waiting for you at McDonald's right now. So I got my PhD in English and I was looking for a job, and I realized I wasn't going to probably get a job in English, in an English department. Chances were like 1 in 500 or something. So I applied for a job as a technical writer for a company named TRW. And TRW is a big internet, I don't even know if it still exists, but at that time it was a big international corporation. And they advertised for it. So I have been living on something like $15,000 a year. If you're just starting out, that might seem like a lot of money, but at the time I was 32 years old, 33 years old, and my brother was making a lot more than that. $32,000 meant I could buy a car and things like that. When I had $16,000, I couldn't have a car. You know, I used to take the bus and things. So the point is, I was really much really making $16,000, and 32 looked wonderful, and that's what this position was offering. And they flew me and Barbara to Washington D.C. We were competing. I was competing with a number of other candidates. They put us up in a hotel, and they gave us spending money. Can you believe this? And when I met them the first time, and they said the salary's 32, I was thinking, oh God, that would be fantastic. And they said, don't worry, it goes up fast. So this was like all of our problems were going to be solved, right? I didn't get the job. You know, I just didn't get the job. I went for the interview, and then they called me up and said, I'm afraid I have bad news, you know, I didn't get the job. And, you know, I wasn't particularly interested in the good life, you know, but for just a second, it was like, my God, we might be, you know, really in a different world all of a sudden. And then it was gone, and the rejection, because we had sort of gotten picked up so high, the rejection really hurt. In fact, Barbara actually cried. You know. And I was, you know, it bothered me a lot. I don't know how to put it. You know. I don't know how to put it, but I was really hurting. You know, I felt like such a washout. You know, I felt like such a loser. And I just thought, you know, I don't have a prospect in the world. I put in all this work, and what am I going to do? You know, I can go back to working for the Mayflower Company, moving furniture. And that's not the end of the world, but at the time, it really bothered me. It really, really troubled me. So I was really in pain. All I can tell you is that this was like very painful for me at the time. And so I sat on the cushion, and I just had, you know, I had these sits that were like amazing sits. It was like amazing sits. I was in such pain, and you know, I just had these amazing sits. And it was that bitter pain that made that those sits possible. It just, and you know, that happens to me sometimes. Things will happen sometimes that just hurt all to hell. You know, like when my dad died, you know, that really hurt, you know. I mean, my whole body hurt. And when I sat on the cushion, it was just a face-to-face with Buddha nature, face-to-face with my true self. You know, so we don't really know, how long we're here, what the future holds, and that life does deal us these things that are very difficult, painful, and unfair. But if we're interested in waking up, these are all dharma doors to enlightenment. These are all dharma doors to enlightenment. So we have to use them. See, this is what Vimalakirti represents. He was sick, but had used his illness to basically encounter Buddha face to face, and used his illness to help other people wake up too. See, when people would come to pay their respects to him when he was sick, his example was so inspiring to others. They'd say, "My God, this is a guy who's, you know, sick, and yet he's so kind and compassionate. He's so awake and aware. He sits on the cushion and meditates, even though he's, you know, not long for this world." He was like a beacon of light to the whole world because of the way he faced his problems. So this is really beautiful. Vimalakirti is really a truly beautiful human being. So, anyway, this is Zen practice. And this is the last day of our sesshin. Please do your very best, as I know you will. When you leave here today, when you go out into the world of troubles, and your troubles are all waiting to help you wake up, even the worst ones, and especially the worst ones. So please practice and prepare yourself for these events, and it's a great honor to be with you all. Great pleasure, great honor.